Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Saturday, the 9th of September. The UN says the system for tackling global warming is working, but nowhere near fast enough. Documents released in the US state of Georgia show the grand jury in the Trump racketeering case also recommended indicting Senator Lindsey Graham and the American scientist who's fallen ill in one of Turkey's deepest caves.
As you can see, I'm up, I'm alert, I'm talking, but I'm not healed on the inside yet, so I'm going to need a lot of help to get out of here.
Also in the podcast, Pakistan says advanced weapons left behind in Afghanistan after the US troop withdrawal are now being used against its soldiers. And the Mercury Music Award goes to...
Ezra Collective represents something very special because we met in a youth club. Do you hear what I'm saying?
The first jazz band to get the prestigious prize. The world is currently way off target in its efforts to prevent dangerous global warming. That is the conclusion of the first official progress report on reaching the Paris climate goals. In its global stocktake, the UN concludes that the world needs a rapid transformation in the way we work, eat, travel, and consume energy. At a news conference at the G20 summit of wealthy nations in the Indian capital, Delhi, the UN Secretary-General, Antonio Guterres, said that the call for action was urgent and could no longer be ignored.
We have no time to lose. The climate crisis is worsening dramatically, but the collective response is lacking in ambition, credibility and urgency. The climate crisis is spiraling out of control. Together, G20 countries are responsible for 80% of global emissions. So G20 countries must assume leadership.
Antonio Guterres. The report does suggest that hope isn't yet lost, with many countries, even those divided by war, working together to tackle global warming. Yuri Rogel is a climate scientist from Imperial College London.
I'm in a place of hope and despair. Despair because we have warmed the planet already well beyond 1 degree. These are worrying places to be in. I also have hope because we see how countries are putting together real plans to change their entire economies, to change their entire societies, and we see how they are being implemented.
Well, for his assessment, I spoke to our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt, starting with the reasons for optimism.
Yeah, let's start with the good. It's always a good way to begin. If you were an alien looking at the world and looking at the challenge of tackling climate change, and you said, what needs to be done? The first thing you'd say is all these weird nations this planet has need to work together. And what the UN's saying today is that is happening. That was the plan after the big UN conference in Paris in 2015. The plan was to get everybody working together on this. And the UN says, look, virtually every country on Earth acknowledges that climate change is a huge challenge and needs to be tackled urgently and is already taking some action. The bad news is we're simply not doing it fast enough at the moment.
In what way?
We need, says the UN, to switch massively over to clean technology, to renewable power. We need to phase down fossil fuels as quickly as possible. Unless the carbon dioxide emissions are captured and stored permanently underground, we need to stop deforestation by 2030 and begin to replant the forests we've lost. We need to change the way agriculture works. We need a systemic global overhaul, is what the UN says. And it's very frank about this. It says, look, this is going to be really expensive. It's going to cost trillions of dollars. It says the developed countries will need to help developing countries. We need the private sector to get on board. But it says we do have the technologies we need to do this. We just need to begin to implement them with more ambition and drive. It can be done, it says.
So what's holding us up? A lack of money? A lack of political will?
A lack of political will is holding us up. A lack of cash flowing into the right places. I mean, this is a call to action for world leaders ahead of the big climate conference, COP28, that's going to happen in the United Arab Emirates. And they're saying, saying, you know, enough of the big speeches. Let's see action. Let's see strategic plans for how you're going to deliver on the commitments. 90% of the world has said they are going to try and get to net zero. OK, so you want to get to net zero. How are you going to do it? Please outline what you're going to do and then start to actually deliver on the targets that are embedded in those strategic plans. That's what the UN wants to see.
You mentioned the money. Hundreds of billions is still spent on fossil fuels and not enough on...
I mean, more than hundreds of billions on fossil fuel, hundreds of billions of subsidies for fossil fuels by governments. And the UN says, first of all, let's get rid of that. Let's try and phase it out. It's a real dilemma. Look, there is a recognition that countries like India, this is something Narendra Modi has been saying, will need fossil fuels to lift hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. And there is a recognition by the UN that they cannot be denied that right to deliver development for their people. But it says we do need to make the transition happen as quickly as possible. That's the real sense of urgency that needs to be engendered firstly at the G20, and then they need to bring that enthusiasm and energy to the COP28 in UAE, which begins at the end of November.
Our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt. Well, scientists say climate change is making extreme weather much more likely. One of the worst affected countries at the moment is Greece. After a record summer heatwave and a series of wildfires, it was hit this week by torrential floods that killed at least 10 people. During a visit to one of the worst affected areas on Friday, the Greek Prime Minister, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, warned that the country was facing a very unequal battle with nature. Sofia Betitsa reports from Greece.
Entire villages are almost completely underwater after the area was hit by the heaviest rainfall the country has seen in decades. Homes have been swept away, others are without power, and several roads have been badly damaged. Even though the rain has eased, many people are still trapped on their roofs. In some areas, helicopters are being deployed to take people to safety.
We find Senia outside her house. She's lived there with her family for more than 30 years. Now, her home is completely submerged in flood water.
I never thought this could have happened, that my house would be under 1.5 metres of water. My home is completely destroyed. I have nothing left. All I have is my work, this house and my children. And now our home is gone.
Climate change is causing more extreme weather. Greece faced its worst summer of wildfires on record.
Many people here are furious at the Greek authorities. They accuse ministers of using climate change as an excuse for poor building projects. I'm standing next to a bridge near the town of Almiros. It collapsed 3 years ago, so they rebuilt it. But now it's completely destroyed again. Many Greeks see this as a symbol of government failure.
Emergency services are still unable to reach many of the worst hit areas because the water is so deep. Teams are preparing for another night of rescue operations. But the concern is that the number of dead will increase further.
Sofia Betitsa in Greece. The new military rulers in the West African state of Gabon have moved faster than other coup leaders in the region to give their regime a civilian veneer, appointing a prime minister in a transitional government. Gabon's president, Ali Bongo, was ousted by soldiers last week after disputed election results gave him victory. The newly appointed prime minister, Raymond Ndong Sima, is an opposition leader who was defeated in those elections. The announcement was made on state TV on Thursday.
Décret numéro 0006 portant nomination du premier ministre, chef du gouvernement de la transition.
Well, at the same time, Ali Bongo has been told he is now free to leave the country, while the coup leader has pledged a return to civilian rule, albeit without giving a timescale. Using a translator, my colleague Julian Marshall spoke to Raymond Ndong Sima. First of all, why did he accept the post of prime minister in a transitional government led by the military?
Because the situation is very tense, and so everyone has to make an effort to make change.
The new military rulers of Gabon have not named a timetable for a transition to democracy. How confident are you that Gabon will see a democratically elected government, maybe in a few years' time?
The military committee said that it was up to the civil society and the political parties to meet and set out the timetable for the elections and to come back to the democratic rule. In coming days, there will be a meeting with all the components of the society to meet to set out that.
Do you yourself have a timetable in your mind for a return to democracy?
I've said in a document that I've published that that should be done within 2 years.
The new leader of Gabon, Brice Oligui Nguema, is a cousin of Ali Bongo. So has the military coup ended the political influence of the Bongo family in Gabon?
No, you cannot end the political influence of a family that has ruled for over 50 years in one day because they are in direct influence.
So what has changed in Gabon, therefore?
What has changed is that the military has refused to beat up the population, and we have a promise that we'll look into the institutions to come back to the democratic rule.
Should Ali Bongo be allowed to travel abroad, as the military government indicated yesterday that he could, or should he remain in Gabon and be tried for gross embezzlement?
What is interesting for people is not to open the case. I don't think it will be viable to open a case at this moment.
Gabon's new interim Prime Minister, Raymond Ndong Sima, talking to Julian Marshall. Last month, the former US President Donald Trump was charged with racketeering in the state of Georgia. He and 18 co-defendants are accused of trying to overturn Joe Biden's 2020 election victory there. On Friday, we learned that the special grand jury in the case had also recommended indicting 20 others, including US Republican Senator Lindsey Graham. Also in the frame were former Senators Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue, as well as Mr. Trump's former national security adviser and three lawyers. But the district attorney decided not to pursue charges against them. I asked our Washington correspondent Gary O'Donoghue why the jurors had recommended those indictments in the first place.
We don't know what their reasoning was because that's not been published, and we don't know what the evidence they saw was. What we really have is just the outcomes, and this special grand jury has spent 7 months effectively investigating the allegations, and at the end of that process they came up with recommendations which involved charging 39 people, including the 19 who were finally charged, but also three Republican senators, one who's still serving, Lindsey Graham, two former Georgia Republican senators, and in Donald Trump's former national security adviser, Michael Flynn. Now, Fannie Willis, who's the district attorney in Fulton County down there in Atlanta, she wasn't obliged to go along with all those charges and all those indictments that that first grand jury recommended. And she set up an indictment involving the 19 and took that to this final grand jury, who effectively rubber-stamped the indictment. That's the process we're looking at.
So it was her decision not to go after these 20 or so people?
That's right. These were only recommendations from the first special grand jury, as it's called. When you dig down into the detail of this report, what we do see is the voting patterns on these various individuals. And you can see, for example, in the case of certainly some of the senators, one of the senators, that there was a fair old chunk of people who voted against indicting Lindsey Graham. And you can see, if you're the district attorney, you might think, well, that's in a sense a test run of what might happen in the real circumstances of a trial. So maybe I don't have the evidence to go ahead with that one.
Lindsey Graham, of course, quite a well-known figure. What's he been saying about this?
He's come out today and given a very long sort of press conference and said he's very worried about this process. He was just doing his job as a senator. That's effectively his defence. And of course, we do know that he was one of those people who rang up the Georgia Secretary of State, exactly the same thing that Donald Trump did, if you remember, in that famous taped interview that was released. But Lindsey Graham says, well, I was just asking about mail-in ballots and whether things were going to be worked properly for the senatorial elections, of which there were two coming up very shortly after the general election. He's not used the explosive language that the Trump campaign has used, talking about politically motivated investigations. But he has said that he stands by Donald Trump. He supported him for president and he would support him again.
Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. 5 years ago, the world was captivated by the rescue of a young football team stuck in a Thai cave system for 18 days. Now, 150 rescuers from around the world have converged on one of Turkey's deepest caves to try to bring out an American scientist trapped a kilometre underground. Mark Dickey was part of an international team exploring the Morca Cave in the Taurus Mountains when he fell ill with gastrointestinal bleeding. He recorded this message.
Mark Dickey from nearly 1,000 metres. I want to thank everyone that's down here and thank the response of the caving community. The caving world is a really tight-knit group, and it is amazing to see how many people have responded on the surface. We're still waiting for communications to actually reach down here, so right now it's a day to 2 days worth of travel for information to get back and forth. As you can see, I'm up, I'm alert, I'm talking, but I'm not healed on the inside yet, so I'm going to need a lot of help to get out of here.
Well, Berza Şimşek of the BBC Turkish services following the rescue operation, she told us the latest on Mark Dickey's state of health.
Doctors are currently trying to improve his condition so that the rescue operation can start. He's stuck down below in 1,040 meter. As far as we understand, he also said in his video message that he can talk, he's alert, but obviously his condition needs to improve before the rescue operation can start.
He is a kilometre beneath the surface, but presumably that's not just straight down.
I mean, I used to do caving at university as amateur, so I'm a bit familiar with the caves. And caves are divided into two. You have vertical caves and you have horizontal caves. This is a vertical cave. This is the third deepest cave in Turkey. And he is stuck down below 1,040 meter. And most of the cave is, I mean, you can imagine as if like climbing to a mountain, but you're doing it underground. You're climbing up and down with a rope. You need to go through twists and turns in narrow spaces. So basically that's the situation he's in right now.
So how will they be able to get him out, and how long could it take?
That's what they're trying to figure out. So as far as I understand, the European Cave Rescue Association has made out a plan. They have divided the cave into seven sections, and there are different teams from European countries, and each country will be taking care of one section. For example, the Bulgarian team will take him from 1,040 meter to 900 meter, and then they will hand over to another team. That's their plan. But the discussion is whether they can now use a stretcher or not. Because it's a vertical cave, you know, it might be difficult to rescue him with a stretcher, which means that he needs to be quite strong before the rescue operation can start. It's a very important story in Turkish press as well, but we will see what's going to happen.
Berza Şimşek of the BBC Turkish service. And still to come on the Global News podcast.
Some of the wives of the male astronauts didn't want the women, you know, flying in the jets with their husbands. So overall, they got through it and NASA is much better for it.
A new book about the challenges faced by the first generation of female astronauts. Before that, Andrew Peach is here with news of this week's Happy Pod.
Yes, this week on the Happy Pod, a familiar voice to Global News podcast listeners, my BBC colleague Orla Gerin, on how she managed to get back into Yemen to catch up with a little boy who teaches his fellow pupils at school. We're also going to hear about a new app that's teaching hundreds of thousands of people literacy skills in the Horn of Africa. We're off to a Greek island where they repair, reuse or recycle pretty much everything. And if you heard me asking for your little win, the thing that's made your week, prepare to meet a US Navy lieutenant in Washington State and a proud dog owner in Western Australia. The Happy Pod in this feed every Saturday.
As I mentioned earlier, the G20 Club of the World's Richest Nations is meeting in India. But two leaders are notable by their absence, Russia's Vladimir Putin and the Chinese President Xi Jinping. The host of the summit, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, is still hoping to use the gathering to highlight India's increasingly important role in the world. And one of the ways he's doing it is by inviting the African Union to join the G20. Speaking at a news conference in Delhi, the President of the European Council, Charles Michel, said he looked forward to welcoming the AU.
for many years, I'm absolutely convinced that we need to make sure that the developing countries, including in Africa, are more represented on the international stage, at the international level. We want decisions that are implemented. We need more inclusivity at the international level.
Well, for more on the addition of the AU to the G20 and details of how India intends to smooth over disagreements about the war in Ukraine, I spoke to our South Asia correspondent, Yogit Ilamai.
For India, in its year of presidency, one of the things that they've tried to project themselves as is the voice of developing countries around the world. And in keeping with that, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi actually wrote to G20 leaders saying that the African Union should be included into the G20. A wider range of voices around the world should be included. There was an op-ed he actually wrote for an Indian newspaper which came out ahead of the summit yesterday. And he said people shouldn't just be looking at the GDP growth or economic growth as a measure for countries. Voices should be heard of all countries around the world. And so I think that's one of India's big efforts, is to portray and showcase its position in the world, but its position as a voice of developing countries.
Now, interesting that two of the countries in the G20 are not sending their leaders, China and Russia. And the head of the UN says that if we are indeed a global family, we resemble a rather dysfunctional one. Is the G20 still fit for purpose?
I was actually at the press conference held by the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, and it was exactly the question that I asked him, because he described this as a pivotal summit. But when you have two really powerful heads of state of those nations not coming, they're also permanent members of the UN Security Council, what really can you hope to accomplish? His answer, of course, was that it doesn't matter who's representing the country. The countries need to understand their responsibility. What India, as the host country, particularly wants is that despite the divisions and the deepening disagreements over the war in Ukraine, that there will be a joint statement from all members at the end of the summit on Sunday. That wording is going to be extremely complicated for them to agree on. But I think what India will look at as a success as the host country this year would be that there's some joint statement that everybody can agree on and is issued.
Yogita Lamai in Delhi. Ukraine's foreign ministry has condemned a visit by a Chinese singer and Chinese bloggers to the Russian-occupied city of Mariupol. Ukraine has been angered by a video that apparently shows a woman singing a Russian folk song inside the ruins of the Mariupol theatre, destroyed by Russian bombing last year, resulting in the deaths of many people. With more details, here's Danny Eberhardt.
It's a powerful rendition. The woman standing on a balcony sings Katyusha. It's a Soviet-era love song to a man fighting to defend his motherland, which became famous in the Second World War. But the video has incensed Kyiv. The destruction of the Mariupol theatre in March last year was one of the worst atrocities of the war. Many people using the building as a shelter were killed. Some estimates put the figure at 600. A spokesman for Ukraine's foreign ministry called the performance an example of complete moral degradation. He's called for China to clarify what he called an illegal visit.
Danny Eberhardt. Pakistan says advanced weaponry left behind in Afghanistan after the US withdrawal is now being used by insurgent groups to launch attacks across the border. The comments came after hundreds of Pakistani Taliban militants carried out a cross-border raid on security posts in the remote mountainous district of Chitral earlier this week. With more details, here's our South Asia regional editor Anbarasan Etirajan.
The foreign ministry in Islamabad said the issue of advanced weapons in Afghanistan merited international attention. It's estimated that billions of dollars worth of modern weapons were abandoned when the US forces withdrew in August 2021. Pakistan says some of the equipment have now fallen into the hands of insurgent groups like the Tehrik-e-Taliban or the Pakistani Taliban. The clashes with the group earlier this week led to the death of 4 Pakistani soldiers and 12 insurgents. The Pentagon has denied US troops had left any of their weapons behind when they left Afghanistan. It has blamed the Afghan military for abandoning their American weapons when the Taliban took over. Islamabad says Pakistani Taliban militants have set up bases across the border in Afghanistan, but Kabul denies the charges. The Pakistani Taliban group has stepped up attacks on security forces after it called off a ceasefire late last year.
Anbarasan Etirajan. Before the end of this decade, an American astronaut could become the first woman to set foot on the moon, more than 50 years after Neil Armstrong. It will be one giant leap for womankind in a journey that began back in 1978, when NASA reversed its previously male-only recruitment process to select six elite women to become astronauts. One of the six, Sally Ride, became the first American woman in space. Here she is talking about her training program.
I really don't think that there is any aspect of the training or of the flight where it's made any difference that there have been women astronauts on the crew or not. The women and the men go through exactly the same training. The women and the men do exactly the same jobs on orbit, and weightlessness is a great equalizer. You don't need to be strong to do things up there. There is really no difference.
Lauren Grush, space reporter for Bloomberg News, tells the story of these pioneering women in her new book, The Six. She told Julian Marshall about their rigorous survival training and how they had to fight the misogyny of their age.
Thankfully, the country had changed during the time between the Apollo program and when the first six women came on board. You know, we had the civil rights movement and the feminist movement, and NASA was getting a lot of questions about why they had not included women and people of color before. And so it was really top of mind for them when they opened up the astronaut corps to a more diverse class of individuals. You know, not everybody was on board within NASA. You know, there are a few men who just weren't used to working with women in a professional capacity like this. There was some friction, a few of them not taking the women seriously. There were also some women who weren't very happy with the women being in the astronaut corps. Some of the wives of the male astronauts didn't want the women, you know, flying in the jets with their husbands. That, but overall, they got through it and NASA is much better for it.
And once selected, these six women then underwent the same rigorous training as the men.
Yes. One of the probably more fun aspects of training was they had to stay current in NASA's fleet of T-38 jets. Some of the women were pilots when they came onto the program, but they only got to fly in the back seat and they weren't allowed to take off and land, though I've spoken to a few of their former colleagues who said that they did maybe let them take off and land when they were in the back seat.
Did NASA, though, have to adapt to accommodate women in space? And I literally mean accommodate.
Yeah, of course. That included things like adding a women's bathroom at the locker room. Also, some of the equipment that they had on board for the shuttle. Obviously, the way that men went to the restroom in space during the Apollo program wasn't going to cut it.
And NASA had absolutely no idea of the number of tampons they had to provide.
Unfortunately, that was something that the male engineers at NASA had to learn the hard way. So there's a really great moment where Sally Ride was performing her bench checks ahead of her flight, where you look over all of the equipment that you have to bring on board. And included in that toiletry kit, she saw a pink plastic, and she had Kathy Sullivan with her at the time to help her out with this. And they grabbed the pink plastic and pulled on it, and out came another pink plastic tube and another pink plastic tube chained together like sausages. And the engineers asked Sally if 100 tampons would be enough for her week-long trip in space. And she politely told them you could cut that in half and you would be fine.
You've spoken about the intense media scrutiny of the women while they were training, but did that change to acclaim when they started to undertake their duties?
It was a mixture of both, obviously some criticism, but a lot of fanfare. It was still very burdensome because everybody wanted to talk to her, everybody wanted to celebrate her. And so she really went through it when she came back to Earth. It was something that really weighed heavy on her. You know, she wound up seeking therapy over it just because of how intense that media blitz became. But yes, ultimately, I think everyone was so enamored with her, that's why it was so chaotic.
Lauren Grush, space reporter for Bloomberg News, telling the story of NASA's first female astronauts in her new book, The Six. The Mercury Music Prize celebrates the best British or Irish album of the year. This year, the Ezra Collective became the first jazz act to win. The band, who met at a club for at-risk youth, recorded their winning album, Where I'm Meant to Be, during the pandemic. They saw off competition from the Arctic Monkeys and Jessie Ware. Here's drummer Femi Colioso accepting the prize.
Ezra Collective represents something very special because we met in a youth club. Do you hear what I'm saying? And this moment that we're celebrating right here is testimony to good, special people putting time and effort into young people to play music. Do you hear what I'm saying?
Well, the jazz musician Jamie Cullum is one of the Mercury Prize judges. What does he make of the Ezra Collective?
It is a very, very tricky thing to be one of the judges on the Mercury Prize. It's curating this incredible list of great current British and Irish music. However, on the night, we crown a winner, and I think Ezra Collective's album was a brilliant album, which is the most important thing. It represents a big leap forward for the band, who've been around now for a while. But actually, I think this year it's a really exciting moment to spotlight what's been happening in British jazz over the last 10 years or so. British jazz has always been exciting, just sometimes it takes a while for the press to catch up. The music itself is bringing together all these elements that make the country what it is and bring it into this joyous sounding music. So all the sounds that make this country tick are coming forth within their music. And it is the sound of a joyous opportunity for a beautiful future. And the band really represent that. And that, for me, is why they won. In order to achieve the levels of virtuosity that they have as musicians, the sheer amount of hours that you need to spend to be that good at your instrument, that good at improvising, the ability to play with that much freedom, the graft is quite unimaginable, actually. And I think that you develop a lot of humility, particularly in that world of jazz, where really you come to the table and all that matters is whether you can play. You don't start playing jazz music to win a prize like the Mercury Prize or to be on television or to be doing interviews. It is something you do because it's inside you and you enjoy the struggle. You enjoy that journey of trying to improve your musicianship and the freedom that you then get with playing with other musicians.
And that was Jamie Cullum talking about the Ezra Collective, the first jazz band ever to win the prestigious Mercury Music Prize. Now, just before we go, a quick thanks to the listeners who spotted our error at the start of yesterday's podcast. Yes, we do realise it is September this month, and not, as I said, November. Thanks to Pradeep and Mickey and Hector for pointing it out. I'd like to say it was a deliberate error, but it was simply a slip of the keyboard. Finally, thanks to Julie Smith-Allen, who thought it might have been my way of checking if you were all listening. Well, Julie, it wasn't, but it's very good to know you are. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast very soon. This one was mixed by Philip Bull and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.